לצערנו ביממה.
Unfortunately, in the last day, there was a tragic incident where our forces unintentionally struck innocent people in the Gaza Strip. It happens in war, and we are thoroughly investigating it. We are in contact with the governments, and we'll do everything to prevent such occurrences in the future.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on an Israeli airstrike that killed 7 aid workers with World Central Kitchen yesterday. World Central Kitchen says it's now suspending its operations in Gaza. The organization had delivered hundreds of tons of food aid to Gaza just in the past few weeks. Famine there is imminent, according to the United Nations, which says half the population in Gaza has completely exhausted their food supply. We're going to talk about this now with Megan K. Stack, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times and a longtime foreign correspondent who has covered Israel. Welcome back to Press Play, Megan.
Thank you so much.
Well, this was a 3-vehicle convoy operating in central Gaza. There was a World Central Kitchen insignia on the rooftop of these vehicles, or at least one of them. And the route was authorized by the IDF. And that convoy was struck by multiple drone strikes. As we just heard, Prime Minister Netanyahu says there will be an investigation. And he says this happens in war, unfortunately, sometimes. But what do you think is the reasonable explanation for what could have happened?
Well, I don't know. I think there are very serious questions because of everything that you just said. The reporting I've seen, of course, is early. I've seen reports that actually, that as you said, there were 3 separate strikes, and that actually at one point, some of the workers had gotten out who had survived the first strike, had gotten out and tried to shelter in another vehicle, which was subsequently hit again by the drone. I did see a report, I think it was from the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, saying that somebody in the military had said that they had thought there was a terrorist on board one of the trucks. Hmm. Now, I think even given that, even if that were true, if in fact this was, and again, I want to be very careful to say, I really don't know what happened.
Yeah.
And I would add that I will be very surprised if we ever find out what happened, because I think, you know, covering Israel through the years, I can't count how many times there's been, you know, an announcement that an investigation will be opened. And I feel like these investigations very rarely yield a truth that seems to satisfy all the questions. And really, a lot of the times the investigations just seem to kind of fritter off into the ether and people move on. So I don't know that we're ever going to find out. I will say that even if there were a terrorist aboard one of the trucks, it doesn't really explain the sequence of events that we're hearing about, because then surely if you had eyes on through the drone, why are you still firing on, you know, aid workers and all of the aid workers? It seems like it was an operation that was designed to kill everybody who was on the trucks.
But I wonder, you know, you say that a lot of these investigations do end up kind of frittering away, but this war is under an intense microscope, and the countries that from which these aid workers came are outraged. And so do you think maybe this time it'll be different? There's just so much anger and so much focus on this particular incident that Israel can't really not investigate or not produce some kind of answer.
Sure. I mean, I do think that's possible. I think it, you know, it could be instructive, for example, to look into the history of when Shireen Abu Akleh, who was a U.S. citizen, was shot dead by the IDF while reporting. You know, again, there were sort of different investigations taking place, and the explanation shifted significantly as time went along. I feel like we kind of do know what happened, but I don't feel like that investigation was done in the most forthright way. And again, that was a U.S. citizen. I don't know. I think that it's also entirely possible because of the nature of this particular conflict, where we've had so many really horrible things happen. And what tends to happen is that another thing happens and it supplants the last thing. Mm. You know, I think it's very important to keep in context that, you know, these aid workers being killed like this is a horrific tragedy. It is also not outside the norm of this war. There have already been I think almost 200 aid workers killed in this war, many of them working for the UN. So, this is happening. It happens, as you said, that these particular workers, most of them had passports from countries that are friends and allies to Israel, which of course should certainly put more pressure on the Israeli government to get to the bottom of it. But look, this is a government that is under investigation right now by the ICJ, which has said that there is a plausible case to be made. They don't, it will be a long time investigation. It's a very serious question. But there is a question of genocide over this particular war. The ICJ, which is the International Criminal Court at The Hague, I'm sorry, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, has ordered the Israeli government to allow for the preservation of evidence and for the documentation because they need it for that investigation. I don't believe that there has been any significant response or follow-through from the Israeli side to preserve evidence. On the contrary, we're seeing a lot of destruction, for example, what we just saw in Shifa Hospital. So there's pressure, but Israel is already under extreme pressure in this war. And so this additional pressure, I don't know. Let's see what happens.
Meanwhile, as I said earlier, the strip is on the brink of famine officially, and it's just a very dire, desperate situation when it comes to food there. The World Central Kitchen, from what I understand, has provided 143 million meals in Gaza in just the past several weeks. So a huge, huge aid organization. They are now suspending their operations indefinitely. So what does this mean? How is food aid getting through to Gazans?
Very little food aid is getting into Gaza, and I think it's a serious, it's a dire situation. I am very sure that we do not know the full scope of what's happening, and I think that when we talk about famine, when you sort of discuss it with people who work in that world of food aid and moving food around and starvation, you have to keep in mind that famine is a statistical threshold to cross. And to get to sort of know if you're there, you have to have pretty good data coming in real time, which no one has from Gaza right now. So the State Department has actually said they believe it's most likely that famine is already present in the north of Gaza. Famine, a declaration of famine, by the time it's declared, there's already been a massive failure. And that's what we're in right now. We're having people starve to death. I don't think we know how many people have starved to death. I think in March, I think we knew there were 30 children who had starved to death, but those are just the ones who happened to get to a hospital and happened to get documented. But, there's so few people who are in Gaza right now able to document, and most people are just sort of trying to eat themselves and trying to survive. So we don't really know the full scale of what's happening. When I reported my piece on famine, I guess it was like a month ago almost that I was reporting. And I talked to people who were in the north of Gaza, and they were absolutely desperate. They had literally nothing to eat. In that, that was weeks ago. So, looking at this in the context, looking at this attack in that context, it is very serious. It is very serious that the main aid organization that's able to distribute food in Gaza is UNRWA, which is the UN Agency for Refugees that's active there. We, the United States, have cut funding to UNRWA and have decided that we'll do so in the future. So that is a big, that's quite crippling to the situation. Israel has already banned UNRWA from operating in the north of Gaza, which is where the hunger is the most acute. And today, as you said, World Central Kitchen has suspended deliveries, and so has another agency called ANERA, which was, after UNRWA, the second largest aid agency that was able to work in Gaza. And they said after today's attack, or last night's attack, that they're also not going to be working in Gaza anymore. So it is extremely, extremely ominous that what we're seeing is, whether it is intended that way or not, and maybe one day we'll get to the bottom of that question, it has mounted into an almost systematic dismantling of any of the systems that were in place that could possibly have fed people in Gaza.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us and providing your perspective.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Megan K. Stack, contributing writer, opinion writer for The New York Times. She was also a longtime foreign correspondent based in Jerusalem. Coming up, a look at how this war has changed attitudes in the United States, especially on the left. Franklin Foer is here to talk about his Atlantic Magazine cover story. It's called "The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending." And later on the show, Florida will soon have a six-week abortion ban, effectively making most abortions unattainable in the Deep South. Our legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, has analysis. We'll have those two stories coming up next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Far-right anti-Semitism has been well-documented over the past decade.
For those who control the levers of power in Washington, and for the global special interests,
hail they Trump. Partner with hail our people. Hail victory.
Jews will not replace us.
The deadly mass shooting in a synagogue in Pittsburgh.
Deadly attack in the community of Poway, about 20 miles north of San Diego.
While spewing anti-Semitic and racist remarks.
But since the October 7th attacks by Hamas in Gaza, anti-Jewish sentiments that had long simmered on America's far left now feel like they're coming to a rolling boil, especially on college campuses and in cities like Berkeley and Oakland here in California, once held up as bastions of progressive acceptance. My next guest argues that the rise of this illiberal left marks the end of a golden age for American Jews, and with that, the end of something uniquely American itself. Franklin Foer is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he makes his case in this month's cover story. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just played that montage that began with a Donald Trump ad from the 2016 campaign. And although we can't see the images because this is radio, the voiceover comes over images like of Goldman Sachs executive Lloyd Blankfein, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, and George Soros, the philanthropist. And of course, there were the chants from the Charlottesville March, Jews will not replace us, and the stories of the synagogue massacres and shooting. And so, okay, these are very violent. These last instances are very violent incidents and examples of anti-Semitism. And you're not arguing that that is the equivalent on the far left. But what are you arguing when it comes to the left and anti-Semitism?
I heard all of those speeches. I saw all of those images. And before October 7th, I have to say that I was primarily concerned about anti-Semitism on the right. I considered that to be the main threat to American Jewry as far as anti-Semitism was concerned. And I personally did a lot to minimize what people were saying about rising anti-Semitism on the left and on college campuses. And then October 7th happened, and it became almost impossible to ignore the ways in which criticisms of Israel, many of which are legitimate, have spilled over into something that is maybe unconsciously or subconsciously, even sometimes explicitly, anti-Semitic. That the word Zionism, which pertains to a specific political context within Israel, frequently has become almost a synonym for Jew. All of the conventional classical elements of anti-Semitism end up getting attached to that word in a way that feels not just menacing, but has actually been exclusionary for a lot of Jews who would like to participate in progressive circles or in campus events, but aren't able to do that because although they may have criticisms of Israel themselves, and although they may not like the war because they support the existence of the state of Israel, they end up becoming isolated.
You've spent a fair amount of time here in California in the Berkeley Public Schools researching what's been happening there. And so bring us up to speed in case we haven't been following that here in Los Angeles. What's been happening in Berkeley when it comes to this?
Well, I have to say, I was a bit surprised that I found the Bay Area as a primary subject in a piece I was writing about American anti-Semitism. But then I started to see what was happening. There were viral clips from various city council meetings that had happened where Israel was accused of fabricating evidence that October 7th had actually transpired. The atrocities of October 7th actually transpired. Then there was a menorah that sat on the shores of Lake Merritt in downtown Oakland that was dismembered and tossed into the water and replaced by anti-Semitic graffiti. And when I started talking to people in the Bay Area, they told me that there had been an enormous upswing in reports of bullying directed at Jewish students. And their fear was that teachers had stoked that bullying inadvertently by teaching about the conflict in Israel in an incessant sort of way that depicted Jews as the villain. And then kids being kids, they took these accusations of Jewish villainy that they were hearing from authority figures and acted on it against the Jews who were closest to them, which happened to be their peers, their classmates.
So, like, what happened to some of these kids?
So one of the strange things that one hears about much, much too frequently is that even among progressive kids in the Bay Area, there's the use of Nazi slurs, the evocation of Nazi imagery that gets aimed at Jewish kids. The Jewish kids have a sense of exclusion. I talked to one kid in East Bay High School who pulled me aside. He happens to wear a yarmulke, and he just started to describe his daily existence to me, the way in which he would walk down the hall and people would make noises mimicking explosions at him as if he was responsible for the bombing of Gaza. When he tried to step onto a badminton court, kids said, "Here the Jews go trying to take people's land again." And he felt like he couldn't really appeal to authority because he felt like the authorities would brush him aside because they'd created this atmosphere where it was okay to teach a one-sided view of the conflict in the classroom.
And Berkeley Unified School District is being accused in a federal civil rights complaint of failing to stop that behavior on the part of students and teachers. Harassment and discrimination against Jewish children. Why do you think this is happening?
So when we talked at the beginning of the show about anti-Semitism on the right, I have to say that there is some connection to this rise of anti-Semitism on the left, that if you were to look at the post-war years in America, one of the incredible things that happened was that anti-Semitism, which had been a socially accepted thing before World War II, was quickly taboo. But then you have the likes of Donald Trump, and then on Twitter, Elon Musk essentially opening the doors to anti-Semites to enter the mainstream of American discourse. A lot of anti-Semites on Twitter who had been banned by the previous regime were admitted back into Twitter by the Musk regime. And it felt as if this old taboo on anti-Semitism had been broken, and suddenly it was socially acceptable to say things about Jews that are horrible. And you would have gotten kind of drummed out of polite society for only a few years earlier.
Right. And let me play a clip that illustrates what you're talking about. And this is from a Saturday Night Live monologue from 2022. It's Dave Chappelle responding to news that Adidas had cut ties with Kanye because of his anti-Semitic remarks.
My first Netflix special, what did I say? I said, I don't want a sneaker deal because the minute I say something that makes those people mad, they're going to take my sneakers away. And I hope they don't take anything away from me. Whoever they are.
Okay, so unpack that for us, if you will. Here he is making a joke, obviously, about Kanye and Adidas and all the anti-Semitism that he had said that led up to the canceling of that contract. You see that as overtly anti-Semitic, what Dave Chappelle said?
I mean, part of the nature of comedy is that you can always wave it away as a joke. Obviously, he was talking about Jews. They were those people that he was referring to who have the ability to take things away from other people, which happens to mimic one of the most classical charges against Jews, which is that they have too much power. They secretly wield it. They punish their enemies. One of the developments of anti-Semitism, especially on the right, is that it's taken this joking form. Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist philosopher, wrote a small book about anti-Semitism, and he said the joke is one of the traditional weapons of the anti-Semite, because either you laugh at the joke, in which case you become an unwitting accomplice, or the anti-Semite can deflect by just saying he was kidding all along and why are you taking this so seriously? And I think that that really captures a lot of the style of the anti-Semitism that we see infecting the broader culture.
You are writing sort of a larger cultural piece as well, not just a political piece, on the state of American Jewry, and that the golden age, as you call it, is gone, is over. First of all, how do you describe the golden age of American Jewry, and why is it gone in your estimation?
So one of the marvels of life in post-war America is that Jews were able to achieve a measure of safety, security, acceptance that was pretty much unseen in the history of the diaspora. And as a result of that, there was this incredible explosion of creativity that happened within within American Jewry. There was a time where it felt as if the great American novel was the great Jewish American novel, where you had television shows that depicted Jews who were doing nothing to suppress their identity, but were actually exuding it. And when I grew up, Seinfeld was the most watched show on television. Dr. Ruth was the national expert on sex. The Adam Sandler Hanukkah song was something that was played in FM radio as part of the canon of holiday music. And it was as if Jews were living in this nation that reflected all of their deepest longings and desires to be accepted. And I'd say that that era has drawn to a close for a couple of reasons. One is, as we've been discussing, Jews, I think, can reasonably feel as if they no longer have the levels of acceptance and tolerance and insulation from anti-Semitism that they once had. Most of the country still has a very favorable opinion of Jews, but you know, my neighbor walking down the street, and this who's a rabbi, she was, you know, somebody rolls down the window and starts saying anti-Semitic things at her, even though she's not wearing a kippah. There's no marker at the foot of my street. There's graffiti that was scrawled that equates the Ku Klux Klan and the Israeli Defense Forces. So there is that. But then there's also this other thing that's happening simultaneously, and it's largely benign and doesn't have any relation to anti-Semitism, which is that this period where Jews occupied this disproportionate to their population role in American life and culture has started to come to an end, which happens for very good and very understandable reasons. It just happens to coincide with this other thing that's happening at this same moment. And you add them up together, and you have the thesis that I have in my piece about the end of a golden age.
So as a Jewish writer, how are you feeling personally?
I feel sad about this. I mean, there are certain things that I never expected to see in this country. And that's part of the shock, which was that I really believed that I grew up in a country that had escaped anti-Semitism, that in the 1990s, the sociologist who studied anti-Semitism had pronounced it essentially a dead phenomenon. It existed, you know, in these fringe places like the Nation of Islam, or, you know, you had somebody like David Duke or Pat Buchanan. They weren't trivial, but they weren't mainstream. And now, just to see people I know and people in my own family touched by it, it shakes somehow my faith in America as a distinct political culture.
Hmm. Well, also that reflects a bit of an American naivete, right? That we can be exempt from the historical tides. The fact that that person wrote that article is about the end of anti-Semitism strikes me as kind of odd given the history. And there's never not been anti-Semitism in the world.
Of course, there's never not been anti-Semitism in the world, but actually, in the golden age of American Jewry, Jews played a pretty significant role in helping to reinvent ideas about American exceptionalism. And one of the things that was said to be exceptional about our nation is that we didn't have the same sort of blood and soil nationalism that you see in European nations. And that one of the things that made America distinctive was that you could get full citizenship in the United States without surrendering your identity. And so I think the end to the type of naivete that you described still comes as an emotional shock.
Franklin Foer, you can read his cover story, The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending, in this month's issue of The Atlantic. Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Florida Supreme Court issues two contradictory rulings. It allows a 6-week abortion ban to go into effect, and it allows a constitutional amendment on the November ballot that would allow abortions until fetal viability.
People of Florida aren't stupid. I mean, they can figure this out. I think there may be a problem as to what it doesn't say.
Those stories are next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Two seemingly conflicting decisions from Florida's Supreme Court on abortion. The conservative court allowed one of the country's most restrictive abortion bans to go into effect, with few exceptions. Beginning May 1, abortion will be illegal after 6 weeks, when many people don't even know they're pregnant. But in a separate ruling, the court also greenlit a November ballot question that would guarantee the right to abortion up to fetal viability, so around 24 weeks. Democrats say having that on the ballot now puts the state in play for President Biden. The state hasn't gone Democratic since President Obama won re-election back in 2012. Joining me now is Press Play's legal Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School. Hello there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's look at the first ruling, the one on the abortion ban. Let's look at that first. They were actually looking at the state's 15-week ban. So how did that turn into a 6-week ban?
Right. So how did we end up here? So this is a 6-1 decision. And as you said, the ruling on the 15-week ban means that the 16-week ban, with exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the woman, that will go into effect. And so why is this the case? Well, back in 2022, DeSantis signed the 15-week abortion ban, and it was immediately challenged in court, but it was allowed to be enforced while it was challenged. So that 15-week ban is what people in Florida have been living under since it was signed and challenged. But then, right before the Dobbs decision in 2023, DeSantis signed a 6-week abortion ban. That was also immediately challenged. Sorry, right after the Dobbs decision. So in that case, was put on hold. So what the court said is basically, we're waiting for the ruling on the 15-week ban. And if you uphold the 15-week ban, then we can implement the 16-week ban. And that's exactly what happened
yesterday. The 6-week ban. Yeah.
6 weeks. Excuse me.
So that's what happened yesterday. Okay. So there'll be a 6-week ban that goes into effect May 1st. All right. And the people who brought the case, a coalition, including Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, they had argued that Florida has in its constitution, unlike the U.S. Constitution, a right to privacy spelled out, and that that would guarantee the right to an abortion. So why did the court not agree with that?
What the majority of the Florida State Supreme Court said is, when this right to privacy was put into our Constitution in 1980, what the court said is that it was understood as about informational privacy and about protecting people's private information from government intrusion, that it was not understood by those who voted for that particular constitutional amendment in 1980 as including abortion. And the Florida Supreme Court essentially said to the challengers, I know that we may have understood that more recently as including the right to an abortion, but that was not the original intent, and it is not covered under the state constitution.
Okay, so this is a setback for supporters of abortion rights. On the other hand, the court also ruled that a constitutional amendment can be put on the November ballot that is seen as a victory for abortion rights supporters. So talk about that decision.
So I will say, actually, I don't view this as a huge legal victory. I think what we have to remember is when it comes to the second decision, which was just about whether or not the Florida Supreme Court would say that this proposed constitutional amendment could be put on the ballot, that their role is actually quite ministerial in a sense. So for the first case that you and I were talking about, Madeline, the question is one of state constitutional interpretation. And the question is one where the policy and ideology of the justices will really come into play. But this second question is really just a gatekeeping question. And the court is looking at something very narrow. They're looking to see, is this a proposed constitutional amendment that deals with a single subject, for instance, just abortion, not abortion and marijuana in one amendment? Is it clear? Number two, would the wording mislead the voters? And then three, there's this very kind of cursory review of, on its face, is this proposal unconstitutional? But the Florida Supreme Court said right off the bat in this 4-3 decision, we have to defer. We have a gatekeeping function. And so this is not a statement by the Florida Supreme Court on whether or not they think this is a wise constitutional amendment or anything like that. Again, just really ministerial.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so already this is having political ramifications, and because we've seen in other states that had these questions about putting it in the Constitution, every single state that has had this on their ballots, and there's just been, I think, six of them, I believe, California, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan, Vermont, Ohio, all of them have voted to put to enshrine abortion rights in their constitution. So now I guess Democrats are licking their chops saying, well, then maybe this could happen in Florida. Any reason to think otherwise?
Well, I think that this will be hugely motivating for Democrats. As you said, it's not just those other states. It's we can look at the midterm elections and we can look at what was discussed by the candidates in the midterm elections. We can also look at state Supreme Court elections like the one in Wisconsin where abortion was a huge issue there. And we can see that fairly across the board, what motivates people to the polls, and not just Democrats and not just women, but also a number of independents, is the idea of protecting abortion on the statewide level. So I think Democrats are quite excited about this because let's also remember, it's not just that we will be voting for president in 2024. There are also a lot of down ballot races that could be affected. And people in Florida think this could affect the Senate race, for instance. So yes, I think Democrats are extremely excited and maybe wondering why didn't they just try to get similar protections on the ballot in swing states.
Mm. Right. And so, but in the meantime, abortion will be pretty much out of reach for most women in unless they enshrine this in the Constitution, but that wouldn't go into effect until next year. So in the meantime, it looks like most of the Deep South, if not the entirety of the Deep South, is now a place where it is almost impossible to get an abortion.
Well, that's right. So this is going to have a huge impact, not just on Florida, as you pointed out, but also on surrounding states. So there was a recent study that said Florida had the second highest increase in the total number of abortions provided after the Dobbs decision. And that's in part based on an influx of women from surrounding states. So a change in policy in Florida is going to be felt throughout the entire Southeast. And obviously what many in Florida have now pivoted to is they've moved away from this litigation strategy. And now the reporting indicates that they're moving towards allowing women to travel not to neighboring states, but out of the Southeast in order to obtain abortions.
Jessica Levinson is our legal and a professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on Press Play, the new Max series, The Girls on the Bus, about women covering a female presidential candidate. We'll talk to the creator, journalist Amy Chozick, who in real life covered both Hillary Clinton campaigns. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time for TV on the Radio.
Life on the campaign trail isn't exactly glamorous. Being away from home for months at a time, living out of a suitcase, chasing sources and writing stories half the country won't believe anyway, it can be a grind.
It is a grind. I've done it. I covered Al Gore's 2000 presidential run. My guest, Amy Chozick, is also a veteran of that grind. She's the co-creator of the new series on Max called The Girls on the Bus. We just heard a clip from it there. It's based on her memoir, Chasing Hillary, about when she covered the 2008 and 2016 Clinton campaigns for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times. And just a note, there is some explicit language in our conversation. Welcome to Press Play, Amy.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so The Boys on the Bus, obviously, this is a reference to the famous, at least in journalism circles, account of reporters covering the 1972 election.
Exactly.
Nixon, McGovern.
Oh, those were the
gosh.
Days.
Those were the days. We all remember those.
You didn't have to file for the web. You could actually talk to the candidate.
Right. You called in your stories and all that. And Hunter S. Thompson was one of the boys on the bus. I had to go check to see who was actually on that bus, but that's kind of surprising. He's a hero of one of the characters in this series. Is he also a hero of yours?
Interesting. I wouldn't say he was a hero of mine, but certainly like Sadie does in the show, I think I romanticized this era of journalism that by the time I got to it didn't exist anymore. This sort of like swashbuckling, pouring yourself into the story, narrative, nonfiction, you know, strain of journalism that I think Hunter S. Thompson really encapsulates. But so, yes, certainly I would have romanticized that era the way Sadie did. I don't think Hunter was as much a hero.
He was kind of an anti-hero, but a cool anti-hero.
Exactly.
So tell me about the broad outlines of your show. There are four lead characters, two from legacy media outlets, a woman who works for a Fox kind of conservative cable channel. Of course, there's the social media influencer. And so tell us about these characters and what you wanted to say, portraying them from these different aspects of media.
Yeah, well, from the very early conversations, we knew we didn't want the show to be based on reality, right? We were living in a no Trump, no Hillary world. We wanted to create a totally fictional Democratic primary. And primarily, we wanted to focus on the friendships that form among the women on the bus covering this fictitious primary. And so very early on, we thought we want four very different types of women, right? Different types of backgrounds, beliefs, and journalism backgrounds. Partly because I think that that is what happens, as you know, on the campaign bus. You become friends with people you normally would have never met in your normal life, and then you're stuck together on a bus. So we thought that friendship-wise was interesting. But also, I think it allows us to play in a lot of debates, right? Debates about what journalism is, debates about everything. I don't know if you've watched the whole series, but in episode 6, they're on the way to the debate when the bus breaks down. The episode is called The Debate. The bus breaks down, and we have all of these different women debating everything on the bus in these close quarters. So I just think it just made for very fun and lively conversation to have these women be from very different backgrounds. And you got to have the influencer in today's bus.
Absolutely. And in real life, are influencers on the bus?
Well, what's interesting is certainly influencers have become a bigger part of campaign coverage. You know, these statistics of 18 to 34-year-olds primarily getting their news from TikTok. Substack is not something we would have written into the show even a few years ago. And now Lola funds her way on the bus via her Substack subscription newsletter. So certainly this has become a much bigger part of coverage.
Interesting. And are you sort of the Sadie character, the one who works for a legacy newspaper?
I would say I'm the most similar to Sadie. She is a mix of what I love about television is it's a collaborative medium. So I would say that Sadie is a mix of my neuroses and Julie Pleck, my co-creator, and Rena Mamoon, my partner running the show. We've poured all of our emotions into her, but certainly in terms of working for a legacy media, her sort of romanticizing old school journalism, her vests, her menswear, that is all closest to me.
You would wear menswear on the bus or in general?
I just love Sadie's wardrobe. I really wanted it to have like an Annie Hall, Diane Keaton sort of men's. I wanted her to dress the way, you know, someone who romanticizes an era, a previous era, would dress. So she even has the like fedora and the high waisted trousers and sort of a vibe of an old school newswoman.
Okay, I want to play a clip where she's trying to convince her editor, this is in the first episode, to assign her to the front runner. And the front runner is a governor named Caroline Bennett. Her editor wants her on a different candidate, a man, because of her past experience covering a different female candidate.
Now, the newsroom brass is still burned. They worry that you live and write in a more emotional space.
That is such bullshit.
Felicity Walker.
What about her? Aside from the fact that she should be president right now.
See, there it is.
I'm kidding.
There it is. Come on.
I'm kidding.
Look, you wanted her to win. And it showed in your work. Hell, it showed on television. I mean, your crying became a meme.
I don't think that many.
The media is under attack. We cannot show even a hint of bias.
Okay, that's great. That's Griffin Dunn there, by the way, speaking of a callback to journalists.
And a great journalistic legacy Griffin Dunn has, yes.
Right. He is the nephew of Joan Didion, for one.
And his father is Dominic Dunn.
Right. And so was he cast on purpose for that role because of that?
No. You know what's interesting? He, we had one Zoom with, he and I both were like, it was this deeply emotional connection, both his connection to his aunt, who he made a lovely documentary on Netflix about, and his character is very much inspired by my mentors, all of my mentors, but primarily David Carr, the late Times media columnist. And he was a big admirer of David. And we had a very emotional connection in our very first Zoom. And it was just, there was no one else who could play Bruce, Sadie's beloved editor, mentor, / father figure.
Mm-hmm. So he's referring to her crying when the candidate she covered, Felicity Walker, lost. And someone filmed it, it went viral. And now she's, you know, 4 years later, I guess, trying to cover another historic candidacy. Is that something that you know personally? I guess I'll just ask you straight up. Did you cry when Hillary lost to Trump?
That did not happen to me personally, but it was actually not about Hillary. It was a reporter I know who covered Elizabeth Warren cried. And not even because, oh my God, I wanted this woman to win so bad, but because when you're covering a candidate, your kind of career and future is very much hitched to that horse, right? So Sadie thinks she's riding that all the way to the White House. She thinks she's getting the White House job she's always dreamed of. She thinks she's moving to D.C. It's sort of a total mix of emotions when a candidate suddenly loses. You know, it's not just, I thought they would have made a good president. It's all of the things, you know, what is going to happen to my life now? And yes, there was a journalist who told me that she cried and got so much shit for it. And that sort of inspired that. But I think the bigger theme is something that women across all industries faces. And this is the Scarlet E, or being emotional, right? Mm-hmm. So whereas Sadie feels like her emotions are what make her a great reporter, all of these other forces are saying, you gotta, you know, hush those emotions. You know, you can't be emotional. Where she feels like the only way to cover a candidate is to pour her heart and her whole soul into it. And it's, women always risk being labeled emotional.
Right. And so you mentioned Hunter Thompson and New Journalism. He poured all of his emotions or his feelings or his opinions into his work, as did many of the celebrated male new journalists of the era. And so is that what she's also trying to talk about, that the women who are trying to write in that style are not allowed to?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Yeah. But I think that's exactly why we wanted Hunter S. Thompson to appear as this ghost on her shoulder, this devil on her shoulder, because I think Sadie, for one, I think a lot of writers have a very loud inner voice, you know, and I think that she has this part of herself saying, go gonzo, you know, write like I did, kid, you can do it. And then she has this more rational, you know, trying to prove to her bosses that she can do it side that says, no, I have to be objective. I have to keep my voice out of it. I can't do that. And so we thought it like kind of personifying that debate inside her with this imaginary friend, Hunter.
So I guess I'm wondering if this, I kept wondering, is this what happened to Amy when she was covering Hillary? Like, did you have these kinds of conversations with your editors?
Not these specific conversations, but I think even since I left journalism, or since the last campaign I covered in 2016, I think these debates about objectivity versus authenticity have sort of erupted in newsrooms in a really important and interesting way. And we don't have the answer, right? But I know that there are factions of journalists that believe objectivity is a myth and we should be honest, that we bring our own perspectives to every story and sort of be honest with the reader about that. And then, of course, I think Grace is the personification of the old school journalist that says, if I can't be objective, I can't do my job. Objectivity is everything to her. And so I think we wanted to play in those debates. I think that those debates have even gotten, I think, more heightened since 2016.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what do you think? Because you've kind of hung up your journalism hat for the time being. You're focusing on screenwriting. So maybe you can talk about it with more, I don't know, openness, perhaps. How do you fall on that objectivity versus authenticity line?
I mean, one of the fun things about putting these debates in fictional characters' mouths is I don't really have the answer, you know?
Yeah.
And I think everything we wrote, I kind of like when Lola says objectivity is a myth created by white men who were covering other white men. They had no skin in the game. You know, when people are coming for my rights and my, my safety, how can you be objective? And so when Lola would make that case, we'd all in the writer's room go, yeah, Lola has a point, you know? And then when Grace makes the case that the only way I can do my job is to be objective, I sort of, part of me thinks, yes, you know, and Grace goes so far as to say that she doesn't vote in elections she covers, which was something that an older generation of Times political reporters would say often. And I think a younger generation would just think that's crazy. You're ceding your right to vote. And so these are the extremes that we get to play in. For me personally, as a journalist, I enjoy the type of journalism where I can be honest with my feelings, with my opinions. I recently wrote a story about Elizabeth Holmes before she went to prison. I very much put myself into the story and in doing so exposed myself to a lot of criticism, which I understand. But for me, the only way to tell that story was not as a straight news story. It was a kind of capturing the surreal weirdness of believing a person who you know you can't believe. And as soon as you leave the interview, you want to check for your wallet, but they're so convincing when you're with them. And I had the privilege of putting myself into that story because it was the only way I knew how to tell the story. So I almost think it's sort of story dependent, but I do think to have the freedom of explaining to the reader that I went in with this bias and this is how it changed my mind or this is how it didn't. Sometimes I think that can be the most honest way to, as Sadie would say, the deeper truth.
Right. Well, I know that has been a question journalists have been batting around for a long time. And I'm thinking about Slate in particular. Every campaign season, they bring up this idea that the reporters covering the candidates should reveal their political affiliations. And, you know, say whether they're a Democrat or Republican or an independent and what they think, just so that the reader can know where they're coming from. What do you think about that?
I take a bet I know where most writers for Slate are falling on the political spectrum. I mean, I would be very surprised if reporters were talking about being registered Republicans, but I don't disagree with the instinct to just be honest and upfront. I hadn't realized that this was also a thing that Robert and Michelle King, who created The Good Wife, but my partners were saying that they were talking about the same thing when it came to judges. You know, should we pretend that who's sitting on the bench is completely objective and only hearing the facts and filtering it through this completely objective, or do they bring their own perspectives and worldview to the job? So I think that that's sort of also applies to journalists, but I hadn't realized that other television genres had grappled with this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it's obvious that people have their biases and their opinions. Mm-hmm. They're not robots or
exactly.
Yet. We don't have AI covering stuff yet.
Oh, God.
I know.
Season 5.
Exactly. There should be an AI's character on the bus. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Amy Chozick. Her memoir, Chasing Hillary, chronicles her time covering the 2008 and 2016 Clinton campaigns. And it's the inspiration for her new HBO series, which is called The Girls on the Bus. I want to play another clip from the show. And this is where Sadie's in the elevator with Senator Felicity Walker, whose previous loss we discussed made her cry. And Walker shows up unexpectedly in Iowa. There's a lot of chatter about whether or not she might jump into the race. And Sadie's trying to get a quote from her in the elevator. Walker hits the emergency stop button and then confronts her.
Sadie McCarthy, still as bumbling as ever, I see.
Sorry?
You should be. You and your newspaper ruined my life. You cost me the presidency with your snark and your sarcasm disguised as wit and whimsy. And that viral meltdown that set women back 100 years, that was embarrassing. You want to give Bennett a shot at the White House? Stay the fuck away from her.
Wow. I'm wondering if you were thinking Hillary Clinton would say these words if she, you and she were trapped in the elevator.
Oh, I'm sure she would and more. No, I'm so glad you played that scene, because to me, that scene really encapsulates the weirdness of covering a candidate, right? Sadie just got this reality check. This is something that was definitely inspired by my experiences, not in that that encounter did not happen. That was a fantasy. But I did, when I came to, when Jill Abramson put me on the Hillary Clinton beat in 2015 for the Times, I was very excited. I had covered her in 2008 in a much sort of less combative role. I guess I was a younger journalist and I wasn't at the Times. And then suddenly, not through Hillary directly, but through her aides, I had learned about all of this baggage that between the Clinton camp and the New York Times. I mean, they were mad at me for Whitewater. You know, I think I was in middle school when that story broke. Wow. But so there was all of this baggage that I had no idea I was walking into. I was just like, isn't this great? I'm joining you. I was very naive about the relationship, the decades of bad blood between the two camps. And so that was just completely surprising. And then the other thing, and you know this as a journalist, often you'll write a story that you think is fine, either positive or just fine. I mean, and then they go absolutely crazy. I mean, I think about the story about Obama snacking on the 7 almonds at the Times, right? Mm-hmm. And they got so mad, they had to correct the... They went on MSNBC to talk about the president's snack regime. You know, you just never know which details are going to really trigger a candidate. And I think Sadie is one of those reporters that, like, loves capturing those, I think reporters would call it human details.
The color.
Yeah, the color, exactly. Candidates would say, like, why did you have to tell everybody that? That was embarrassing and, you know, you're snarky. And so this was a wake-up call for Sadie, but it also, what I love is it sets her up to be a better journalist, honestly, because she says, okay, I know how you feel about me. And it's kind of heartbreaking, but now I can just cover you and do my job. And so it is that's a pivotal scene. I'm so glad you played it.
Yeah. And I think it captures also that uncomfortable notion that you think you might be closer to the person you're covering than you actually are. And you write in your book that you really didn't know Hillary Clinton. Like, even though you spent years trying to figure her out, following her around, watching her, you two never really connected. I think you had one interview with her. Is that right?
No, I've had more interviews with her than that, but certainly, oh, okay. I mean, certainly, yes, I think she remained an enigma, you know, not just to me, but to the country. And so I do, yes, of course. I always say it feels a little bit like following, like being in love, except there is no love. You know, you think about them always and they think about you never, you know? And so I think this is what Sadie's going through. Not that she loves Walker, but she's thought about her so much. She thinks they have some kind of relationship. And then she gets in the elevator and is like, nope, I think about you never. And if I do, it's in a negative way.
God, that's such a come down. But at the same time, they do think about the press coverage all the time, right? And
yes.
Hillary Clinton certainly did. And was wondering why she got such negative press coverage, but then didn't want to engage with the press. And so it's a difficult balance, too. And also a difficult balance as a journalist, because you don't want to be buddy-buddy with the candidate. But you do want to get access to the candidate. And I remember being jealous of my colleagues who were on the George Bush bus, because they were always getting buddy buddy with the candidate.
Yes.
And Al Gore never talked to us. He was like a proto Hillary.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that was probably very similar to covering Hillary.
Yeah, there was like nothing there. So yeah. Lots of lock boxes, and that's about it.
The frustrating thing about Hillary is that I got to know like all of her friends from childhood to Arkansas to, you know, to college, and they would always say, if only the public could see the Hillary we see, the funny, sarcastic, fun Hillary. And I would say, well, the media is the conduit to the voters. So if we don't never see that Hillary, you know, I can, of course, say her friends said she is like this. But I think it's hard when you never see it for yourself. It's very hard to communicate that to readers. But it was also like a frustration in her camp that people don't know the real her. So it was this cycle,
right,
that you're reminding me of now.
And the fact that she was, as you mentioned, burned or felt burned by the media, by the Times, long before you were even on the scene with Whitewater. But of course she felt burned after, well, the emails during the 2016 campaign. And you write about that in your book, about how the New York Times made a very quick decision to write about these emails that were stolen by Russia. And, you know, that really changed the election. And you write in your book that you regret that.
Well, there's sort of two questions in that, right? There's her personal email server,
Right.
And then months later, there was the WikiLeaks hack into
the John Podesta
yeah. campaign emails. But yeah, I mean, there's no question that Hillary Clinton built up a protective armor that made the real her an enigma. But I also think that, you know, in retrospect and in digesting everything, you sort of understand that she was in very careful pursuit of something that generations of women have hoped for, right? So if she built up those protective walls and if we found her to be an enigma, I think it was because she was in careful pursuit of this thing that we have never seen a woman do before. And so I think kind of digesting all of it in after you're living it in real time, because it's very hard to, in the heat of a campaign, to kind of see the bigger themes. But yes, of course, you see why that happened.
Right, right, exactly. And you see why the Times would write about the John Podesta emails, because there was a lot of information there, I guess. I don't know. Would they do that today, do you think, knowing what they know?
I have no idea. I have not covered, you know, 2016 was the last campaign I covered. I do certainly think that today there is a bigger emphasis on where these hacks came from mm-hmm. and the motivation. I mean, this was before 2016, but certainly in the Sony hack, there was a lot of talk about North Korea being behind it. I think people found the bigger, more interesting story that a foreign adversary decided to hack a Hollywood studio and why. That was sort of the more interesting story than the salacious gossip that Hollywood executives put in their emails.
Right.
And so I certainly think that there's perspective that a foreign adversary attacking an election is a bigger and more interesting story, potentially. It depends on what's in the emails, I guess, but mm-hmm. but definitely more interesting than sort of minutia and gossip in emails.
But did the Times know at the time where these emails came from, aside from that they were from WikiLeaks?
That's a good question. I think there were hints of it, but not. No, we didn't know the extent of the attack and where it came from. And certainly it was, you know, it was Hillary Clinton's campaign wanted to put it on the Russian. So I think there was a lot. And again, I wasn't involved in the kind of national security reporting. I don't, to be honest, totally remember when they confirmed that. But yes, there was a lot. You know, you get all of these emails and. Right. You start looking through them for something that's newsworthy. And again, it's not really reporters' job to care. A lot of the things journalists get are from opposition research. They're from a mm-hmm. candidate that wants to hurt another candidate. I think your job is to say, is this newsworthy? Is it legitimate? Is it factual first? Which is, you know, kind of Sadie's journey also in the show.
Right, right. So, yeah, she does a lot of growing up, or she's got a lot of growing up to do mm-hmm. on the show.
Yeah.
That's from what I've seen so far. Yeah. So is that how you felt, too, that after you went through the various campaigns? I mean, it does feel like you're aging in dog years when you're on a campaign. But did you feel that you had changed significantly after you finished covering that campaign?
I think the whole country changed and we're still changed. So I can't say that I was different than, you know, certainly I had the privilege of having a front row seat, but I can't say that I changed, you know, dramatically more than the country, because I think a lot of things changed after that election. I mean, for Sadie, she starts out romanticizing the boys on the bus and just wanting to become one of the boys on the bus. And then I think over the course of the season, she realizes, I can't be like the boys on the bus. I have to be better. And I think that's something that women find in a lot of different industries. Like, I want to be just like that. And then we can't just be just like that. We have to be better. So she is definitely on this journey. Of course, my journey ended at the end of the Javits Center. Sadie is still mm-hmm. is still on this quest to become a better journalist. And I think that's where we get her at the end, especially bringing in her friends and working on this investigation that will launch her into a deep web.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. So at Javits, not a tear came to your eye when you watched Hillary in that purple and black suit?
Well, that was the next day. That was her concession speech. I was really exhausted. I hadn't slept in like 2 days because we went to vote with Hillary in Chappaqua. And then it was Javits and I was up all night. And I was, yes, I think I was very frustrated. And I can't remember. Did I write that? I was very frustrated that I wasn't getting to write the story and I was exhausted and sleep deprived. So it was a whole mix of emotions. But yes, certainly there were a lot of emotions
And also that you wouldn't be covering the White House, I guess.
Yeah, it's just like your whole life kind of goes up. You know, we were like looking to move to D.C. and you think in talking about coverage when you get we were planning stories to do during the transition. I mean, you do all the things when you think that this candidate is going to become president. So then suddenly to like wake up the next day and you're like, all right, what do I do now? I've also spent years and years like establishing sources and I know all of these random facts about this person who's not relevant to American politics anymore. Not to say that she's not relevant, but certainly, you know, not going to become president. It's a strange feeling. It's a contact sport, politics, right?
Absolutely. So speaking of, do you see any parallels between now, aside from the same candidate is running, to 2016?
It's a good question. You know, I see the same sort of complaints from about coverage, about tracking polls too closely, believing polls when we're this far out, when we shouldn't we have learned that polls don't matter, those types of things. I mean, I am kind of blissfully writing for TV and film now, so I'm not as deep in it, but I think that 2016 was real watershed and we're still seeing the ramifications of that.
Yeah, I mean, you still have Trump. Trump is still there. Could be president again. So do you have that in mind as you are writing this series? Are Trump and Hillary kind of on both of your shoulders in a little bit, in a way, when you're writing this?
No, and that's something I loved about from the very beginning of the project when I talked to Greg Berlanti about what we wanted to do is that we wanted to play in a fictional world. You know, I'm sure someone will create a game change like movie or show about 2016. That was not at all what we wanted to do. And it was really liberating. We're living in a completely Trump and Hillary and even Obama free world. And it's kind of interesting in a writer's room because if you're living in a fictional world and you have to decide like what was reality, like I have a John Edwards joke. I have a Anthony Weiner joke. I have a lot of Gary Hart jokes. At some point they were like too many Gary Hart jokes, but you know, so you have to decide like what was still real. And we ended before Obama. So basically that none of that exists. And it just allowed us to create a fictional world. That's hopefully idealistic, hopefully escapist. I mean, we have a fun, raucous, hilarious primary in episode 3. Scott Foley does a magic mic, strip tease. It's a fantasy, but it's still like we're having fun in our raucous Democratic primary, and I hope it's an escape. I mean, certainly we got all of those candidates off our shoulders and just had fun.
I guess it might make people wish that the reality is as fun because so far, it doesn't seem that fun.
I hope it's an escape for people. You know, I was really intrigued by people binging The West Wing during the Trump years. Uh-huh. And I'm hopefully we create a similar sort of, you know, idealistic escape from the ugliness of politics right now.
Amy Chozick, she's the author of the book Chasing Hillary. And that is the basis of a new series called The Girls on the Bus, her experience covering a major presidential campaign, which you can see Thursday night streaming on Max. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you again tomorrow.